Our third case for this morning is submitted on the briefs. That's Kuznar against Kuznar. So we will proceed to our final case of this morning, United States against Chaichula, 12-3695.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and my colleague, I represent Maria Chaichula. And the government and the defense here, Your Honors, agree that the district court did not discuss or identify statements made by the defendant that it considered perjurious, nor did the district court articulate a basis for imposing the two-point enhancement for obstruction of justice at sentencing. Where we disagree is on the issue of whether or not the error was harmless.
So let me just say, aside from my slight bafflement that there's an appeal here given the sentence that Ms. Chaichula received, it appears to me that the issue that was in contention at the sentencing stage was not whether the statements the government had identified were false, but instead the diminished capacity argument. And so it seems to me that if no one is contesting the falsity of the statements, the district judge can be forgiven for thinking that she doesn't have to go through and pinpoint exactly which statements before the grand jury were false. As I read the transcript, she seems to say, she seems to accept the fact that these are false statements, and a number of them do seem to be blatantly false if we're here on plain error review.
And, Judge, our concern was in reviewing the record, and I did not handle this case at the district court level, but our concern was the complete disregard for any clear examination on the record. Though there, I believe, were five statements brought up by the government, four that were attested to in the PSR. Judge Coleman, though, doing a very thoughtful job at trial and also at sentencing on the other points that were in contention at sentencing, did not at all address the obstruction of justice arguments. She did not say, I adopt the PSR. In fact, she did not adopt the PSR. She came up with a different calculation than the PSR author did. She simply said, after addressing all the concerns the defense had regarding the other enhancements, and as to obstruction of justice, this is an exact quote, but it was along the lines of, I'm going with it. And our concern is, in the cases that have been before this court, we have seen that though it's preferable to this court that the three elements of perjury are addressed, it's certainly not necessary as long as there's a predicate finding based on the elements of perjury. Here, our concern is there was absolutely no discussion. And I think...
Doesn't she say at one point that Ms. Chaichula was sufficiently knowledgeable to understand that her reports to investors of signed contracts and imminent cash flow were false?
Your Honor, I apologize to you if I'm misstating the evidence, but I believe that was something that came out in the jury, after the bench finding of guilt. And my concern here is that when I think about the Johnson case, it's concerning to me that in that case, this court found it was not a sufficient basis to impose the enhancement based simply on the jury finding that the defense testimony was not credible. So there was absolutely no discussion of the grand jury testimony. The other concerning thing to me, and I didn't see this acknowledgement of falsity of the statements, was it begs the question whether the grand jury testimony was crucial to the determination of the defendant's guilt. Was it material? There was so much other evidence presented at trial, thousands of pages of testimony. There were bank records, hundreds of pages of bank records, witness investor testimony, which supported the government's case. There were investment statements that were provided by Ms. Chaichula and her co-defendants, who were both fugitives. The statements provided by the defendants were directly contradicted by the bank statements, which were discussed ad nauseum at trial. So I'm concerned whether or not these grand jury statements, the five that were mentioned at sentencing, were material. We also...
But when we think of the definition of material, it isn't were these going to tip the balance at trial? It's really, would a reasonable person take this into account in their affairs? And when she tells the investors, she tells the grand jury that she didn't tell the investors that they're a $1 billion company. But there's an audio recording and a transcript in which she is telling an investor, we're talking about a $1 billion company, that's what we are. That fits the definition, the legal definition of materiality, surely.
And Judge, that may be the case. The other thing that comes to mind with that particular statement or the other four brought up by the government is the district court made an acknowledgement, not only orally at sentencing, but also in the statement of reasons that she had taken very seriously these discussions of the mental health, the diminished capacity of this particular defendant. And I would submit respectfully that the diminished capacity that everybody acknowledged at trial and also at sentencing greatly impacts the examination of these three elements of perjury. The concern that I strongly have here is,
why does the diminished capacity have anything to do with materiality? I certainly can see that it has something to do with culpability, and the judge seems to have taken that into account. But the listener doesn't know whether that person is listening to somebody who's got all their wits about them or has diminished capacity. I don't see the link.
I'm not sure if that's true, Judge. I'm thinking about a statement that Judge Coleman made. I believe it was at the trial where she said, when she was about to give the verdict or maybe directly following, where she said, I call into question how some of these investors could give Ms. Chichula money based on what she had seen. I'm paraphrasing here and summarizing. In that, Ms. Chichula comes across as a little bit loony. She did not use the word loony. I can't remember her exact quote. So I think in that sense it might impact materiality. In terms of falsity, there was a lot of discussion about how Ms. Chichula was delusional. And I think that that might go to whether or not her statements were false. There was a lot of
the judge says, though, in the end, she resolves that really adversely to Ms. Chichula. She says she understands enough to know what's right from wrong, what's fiction, what's fact. So
I guess that our biggest concern, following what I've already said in the brief and then here today, would be if we create law that makes it possible for district courts to not examine certain aspects of an enhancement, in this case the three elements of perjury, then what is there for the appellate panel to review? And I think that needs to be a strong concern. It makes it close to impossible to review what goes on in the lower court if there is absolutely no discussion as to the finding for this particular enhancement.
Okay. If you'd like to save a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Fullerton.
May it please the court, counsel. The district court could have said more.
Should have said more. You can go that far, Mr. Fullerton.
A lot more. Should have said more. But what happened at sentencing, we think, is enough to have merited the obstruction of justice enhancement and to survive on
But our imprimatur on this, I mean, whether it's harmless or there are other ways of saving the verdict is a different matter, but the law is pretty clear that you're supposed to identify the statements that were false and make the findings.
Well, the district court did adopt the PSR, and that's at page ...112 of the appendix. The PSR did identify, it's at the bottom of page 112 of the appendix, and the PSR did identify the four or five statements to the grand jury that the defendant had made, which were the basis for the seeking of the enhancement. Now, the PSR identified them as false, but didn't speak about their materiality and the willfulness of the statements. But this is a fraud case about basically false claims of business success on which the district court had convicted the defendant at a bench trial.
Does it matter that it was a bench trial? Does that should that alter the way we look at it because the judge sat through all of the evidence and made the determination of guilt?
Well, I think it matters in the sense that the district court had already made some findings that about the falsity of the statements, about the nature of the fraud scheme, and those findings that the district court had made on the beyond a reasonable doubt standard could be imported to sentencing. I don't think they need to have been repeated, and they didn't have to be made anew because they had already been made. So
don't they need to at least be referred to? I mean, I'm having trouble reconciling what you're saying with the what I thought was pretty well-established law on what you need to do when you're focusing on false statements. I mean, we've said over, not just us, the Supreme Court, the Dunnigan case, you know, other cases have said that you've got to have, you have to review the evidence and make independent findings. That's from Dunnigan.
And she didn't explicitly make those findings. She adopted the PSR. She had convicted the defendant of this fraud scheme involving false claims of business success. Clearly, there was not an identification of this statement was false, that statement was false, and so on. But so any mistake, though, that the district court made here, and as you pointed out, Judge Wood, the argument at sentencing here was about the state of mind, not about the falsity and materiality. But any mistake that the judge made in failing to articulate the basis for the enhancement we think is harmless because clearly the record was overwhelming that the statements identified in the PSR were false, they were material, and that Ms. Chichula had said that to the grand jury willfully in an attempt to ward off the impending indictment, to evade responsibility. There was no doubt about what was going on here. So for that reason, we'd ask you to affirm the sentence of the district court.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Ambrosio?
For Fullerton's statements about the judge adopting the PSR, and I'm sorry I can't recall the case. It may have been the Savage case where this court found it was enough that the district court adopted the PSR findings, but in that particular case, the judge also made specific comments about the statements that were allegedly perjury in the PSR. We don't have that here. Regarding error, Judge, I want to make note, we are all aware that we have an 87-month variance from the low end of the guidelines here. That's significant, certainly. But I have no doubt if this case were remanded, Judge Coleman would do a very careful analysis of the elements of perjury. And it is possible, we cannot know, as we found in the Love case, that she wouldn't take that 87 months off the newly calculated range, which without obstruction would be 108 months.
Well, the Love case was based on a government's concession that there was harmful error, and we don't have that concession here.
No, Judge, you're correct. We only have the concession that there was no real discussion of the elements. I just wanted to make that point that the 87-month variance at a recalculated range would be 21 months, which is significant. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.